gender. The best are working here to teach sciences of many types. We manage the process of learning until the students graduate and can go and serve the community.
There are a lot of students at the University of Al-Kafil and the University of Al-Amin that are fully paid from the Al-Abbasi Holy Shrine here.
But it isn't just in Karbala where the scholars have rallied. Over in Najaf, I found that more clerical elites are spearheading their own projects too.
We have two projects with UN support. The first is related to helping Iraqi women, including the young, who receive abuse in society. The second helps to protect refugees from the wars, who may have been abused too.
There is blankets, there is food, daily food we give them, so we want them to feel proud. She will feel herself secure and sit at home. This is in our society.
Iraq's political class have become largely synonymous with corruption and are slow in implementing reforms. But where the state has failed Iraqis, the Islamic establishment have rushed to the rescue, proving that it is Islam, not Western-style democracy, which is saving lives here. Robert Carter, Baghdad.
In this segment, that notorious hour-long call between the U.S. President Donald Trump and the Republican Secretary of State in the state of Georgia that he lost to the president-elect, in which the former has asked the latter for special favors. Richard Sedan joins me now with that story, with the social media reaction as well. And Richard, a blatant, brazen abuse of power is how you would describe it.
A massive, massive, huge story, which everyone's talking about and is definitely trending online, as you say. Now, basically what's happened is Donald Trump got into a conversation with Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State. And in a nutshell, it sounds like Trump has berated Raffensperger in the conversation. Trump then took to Twitter to say Raffensperger hasn't got a clue. And then Raffensperger replied and said the truth will come out. The audio of the conversation was then leaked. Let's take a listen to a snippet of that conversation.
You should want to have an accurate election, and you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, I know you don't. No, no, you don't. You don't have. Not even close. The people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
You listen to that, Richard, and you hear begging and berating and veiled threats against the Secretary of Georgia. How is he going to live this down?
Well, I don't think he can. I mean, Trump is heard saying he just needs 11,000 votes, but he may well find himself in legal hot water as a result of this. And really, you know, this has got the feel of the kind of last days of Rome, you know, the fall of Trump's reign. You know, he's increasingly embittered, he's delusional. But I mean, I suppose the other side of the coin might be that some might say he really believes he won the election. Which would make him, of course, the only Republican to... last time he went Democrat, rather, was in 92, I believe. And I suppose this is symptomatic of the fact I don't believe Donald Trump has any intention of vacating the White House on time, in a smooth and timely fashion. And I think we can expect more controversies like this in the coming weeks. But make no mistake, Saeed, a massively, massively embarrassing chapter for Donald Trump.
It sure is. And at the same time, a lot is happening on January 6th as well, Richard. Bring us the online reaction.
Absolutely. Let's go to David on Twitter, first of all, who says, actually, the first impeachment was almost certainly central to Trump losing the election. Impeachment now is clearly called for, given Trump demanding another 11,000 votes. Guests will have to disagree. Some are saying this is a impeachable offense. Ms. Cotts says, Trump committed a crime under Georgia law, criminal solicitation of election fraud, as the Supreme Court held in Trump versus Vance 2020, a sitting president is subject to criminal process. So when he enters Georgia, he can be arrested and charged.
Allow me to take you to your second story, Richard, and an update on the fatal shooting in March last year of young black medic Breonna Taylor by police in Louisville, Kentucky.
You know, fatal shooting, some call it premeditated murder, but regardless, the world is continuing to look at the case of Breonna Taylor, and to that end, we've learned in recent days from reports that two police officers involved in Breonna Taylor's killing will be fired. Those officers are Miles Cosgrove and Joshua James from the Louisville Police Department. Cosgrove fired at least three shots, killing Breonna Taylor, who was shot on the morning of March the 13th. And of course, Breonna Taylor was at home, asleep and unarmed. And of course, you know, this case fed directly into the massive Black Lives Matter protest movements we've seen around the world. But the reality for the Breonna Taylor case, I'm afraid, if you listen to what people are saying, they are saying this case is designed to be a very slow process indeed, which will almost inevitably result in no officers facing jail time. This is how many people are viewing this at the moment.
Probably why some of the activists have been saying that justice is far from served. Tell us what people who have been following the story have been saying online.
Let's go to Hoosier on Twitter, who says, "Abolish the system that allows the murder of Breonna Taylor to occur." George on Twitter says, "More than a year before Anthony Warner detonated a bomb in downtown Nashville on Christmas, which happened recently, officers visited his home after his girlfriend told police that he was building bombs in his RV trailer. The cops did nothing, but they easily got a no-knock warrant for Breonna Taylor." An interesting contrast there. And Justice for Breonna Taylor tweets, "Today marks 297 days since Breonna Taylor was murdered by Louisville police. None of the officers responsible have been charged. Final point, Saeed, most people would say for justice to be done, these officers need to be jailed."
They need to be jailed. Well, we'll keep that in mind, and I'm sure you'll bring us the updates as and when you get them. Richard Sudan, thank you. Well, the clock has beaten us again. Thanks. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
American police violence is off the charts compared to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the UK and nearly 170 times more than Japan, says Alan McLeod Ryder in an article titled "Killer Cops: US Police Killed Over 1,000 Americans in 2020. Stay tuned, please, for the details. American law enforcement officers have killed well over 1,000 people in 2020. Between January 1st and December 15 of 2020, the Mapping Police Violence Project has recorded 1,066 people nationwide killed at the hands of the police, an average of around 3 killings per day. Despite the fact that 2020 has brought with it a pandemic forcing Americans to stay off the streets and presumably out of trouble as much as possible, there have only been 17 days recorded this year where the police did not kill someone. The project also compiled statistics on the racial backgrounds of the victims. Black people are 3 times more likely than white people to be slain by police and more likely to be unarmed when it does happen. 8 of the 100 largest city police departments kill black men at a higher clip than the U.S. murder rate. Those 8 are Reno, NV, Oklahoma City, Santa Ana, CA, Anaheim, CA, St. Louis, Scottsdale, AZ, Hialeah, FL, the Madison, and WI. Death by cop is a leading cause of death for black males in the U.S., killing 1 in 1,000. U.S. police violence is off the charts in comparison to other developed countries, with homicides occurring at a per capita rate almost 70 times that of the United Kingdom, or nearly 170 times more than Japan. This puts it closer to many Latin American nations, notorious for their corrupt and militarized police department's heavy-handed response to drug smuggling and organized crime. May 3rd was the deadliest day in 2020, with police killing 9 men in California, Colorado, Florida, Indiana, Kansas, North Carolina, and Texas. Perhaps the most infamous day came 3 weeks later, however, when police killed 7 men, among them 46-year-old African-American George Floyd. Floyd would likely have been as anonymous as the other 1,065 names on the list had the incident not been caught on camera and gone viral on social media, causing a worldwide uproar. Video showed Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin pressing his knee into Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes until he suffocated to death, even as onlookers pleaded with him not to kill him. Floyd's final words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry, sparking hundreds of large demonstrations nationwide. Between 15 and 26 million Americans are estimated to have attended at least one related protest in the subsequent weeks. As a response to the demonstrations, Chauvin was arrested and charged with second-degree unintentional murder and second-degree manslaughter. He was released on bail in October. However, his situation is unusual. Mapping police violence numbers show that only 1.7% of killer cops are ever charged with a felony, and far fewer are actually convicted, meaning there are very rarely any serious negative consequences for those that do kill while in uniform. The protests sparked a nationwide debate about the role of the police in the society, with polls showing that up to 39% of the U.S. approved of the measure to defund the police. Even more popular were actual police proposals of removing police responsibility for situations like mental health crises and homelessness, measures that would make up the backbone of any police defunding agenda. Despite being responsible for hundreds of brutality incidents during the subsequent protest and hundreds more attacks on journalists, police themselves claim to be under assault. After a police officer was killed in Washington State in July, the institution's defenders suggested that the Black Lives Matter protests were morally responsible. Anytime the anti-police rhetoric heats up, it sends a message that it's open season on law enforcement. We saw it in 2016 and we're seeing it in 2020, a retired senior Secret Service agent told ABC News. Yet, the U.S. government's own data does not back this up. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, law enforcement is not a particularly dangerous profession. Virtually any other job performed mostly outside, from construction work and gardening to agriculture, fishing and forestry, all carry far more risk of death than being a police officer. Also more dangerous are professions where driving a vehicle, such as garbage collection, delivery driving, or trucking, is a key component of the job. The 2020 presidential election was colored by the debate around police violence, with the incumbent president, Donald Trump, accusing Joe Biden of being in the pockets of radical anti-police leftists. In reality, however, Biden appeared hesitant to criticize the police at all, initially suggesting only that they shoot suspects in the leg rather than in the torso. The 78-year-old Delawarean also chose former prosecutor Kamala Harris, who described herself as California's top cop, as his running mate, all of which suggests that it is unlikely Americans will see a massive drop in police violence figures come 2021.
Inside Israel.
The year 2020 is coming to an end. For Israel, it was a year of crises, from the political deadlock, which many argue is still ongoing, to the continuous anti-regime protests. Tel Aviv has had a lot on its plate. What are the protesters protesting? Well, every crisis Israel is in. First and foremost, they want an end to the coalition regime led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They also want the regime to finally pass a 2020 budget. Yes, that's right. Israel has yet to pass a 2020 budget, impacting many Israelis.
This thing against the Prime Minister was involved in the three accusation. He should resign immediately, in my opinion, because the way the country goes, it's the wrong direction.
The latest NGO group says this is impacting many Israelis. The group says that over 20% of Israelis are living in poverty, and hundreds of thousands of children don't have meals to eat at home. That was in 2019. According to Israel's latest, that number shot up about 50% this year.
So now we are facing winter. And I personally know people who sometimes sit at home with three blankets because they're afraid to turn on the heating because they're concerned that they won't have enough money to pay electricity, for example. So when you see in the society elderly people or children who live in severe food insecurity and poverty, you understand that this is not the right way, and we must morally and ethically and humanly, in terms of human and humanitarian approach, to take care of these vulnerable populations. The minimum wage is not high enough, so people who earn minimum wage also live in poverty. So this is one arena. We also need to invest in education, in housing, in the health system, that more people invest private money if they have to get better health treatment. But if you don't have money, so sometimes you won't get the right treatment, or if you don't have money at all, you won't buy medicine, for example, because you need to pay the house rent and so on. So the some examples is, for example, to increase the minimum wage, and also the allocations that the government give to families with children or to elderly people. I'll give you an example. If you're an elderly people in Israel and you don't have pension, and you relate only on the government allocation, you will live in a poor situation. I mean, you will be poor. So this is something that we must change, because elderly people cannot go to work. And if they rely only on the governmental aid, it must make them live in dignity.
Israel had to have a third election in April just to form a coalition cabinet. Even then, Israel was going for a fourth election. The political deadlock in Israel is taking its toll on the economy, policies, and society, as the current caretaker cabinet is limited in its ability to enact concrete policies. The situation has become so bad that there is a butter crisis, where shoppers cannot find butter due to an acute butter shortage that has been blamed on Israel's political deadlock. The regime has yet to pass a budget for 2020. According to the latest NGO, there are 2.3 million Israelis living in poverty, but that figure is up 50%, latest claims. The other is by National Insurance Institute, which reported that the elderly and children are most vulnerable. Things are going for the worst too. Earlier this year, Israel's economy has entered the biggest recession since Israel was incepted onto Palestinian lands in 1948. According to the OECD, Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio is expected to be 75% this year and rise to 88% in 2022. Moreover, 20% of the Israeli working population is unemployed. With two lockdowns because of the coronavirus and a third one looming, Israeli workers and business owners are angry. Small business owners even went on a strike and led a rebellion against regime orders to lockdown. To make matters even worse, the political deadlock seems to be ongoing, as yet a fourth election in less than 2 years also looms in Israel.
The problem is that many budgets, such particularly for old people, for children who need help in terms of development or things of the sort, so these budgets that normally would be extended or added, these budgets are basically frozen. So as a result, you can see quite a few programs that are frozen and population that do not receive the social conditions that they were expecting to get. Many people vote for parties that they are not really excited about, only because they want to maintain the government or replace the government, even though they do it out of desperation, because they see that there's no significant leadership in the future. Netanyahu, who was very effective in the beginning, over the time he became exhausted. And the Netanyahu that we have today is exhausted, is not effective. All he does is cling to his political situation and fight the legal system that is working against him. So many people are really frustrated because the current government is not effective and the alternative is not serious. So we really feel that we are living in a vacuum.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Yuri says Netanyahu deprives Israel of its annual budget, forcing hundreds of thousands of citizens into economic chaos, unemployment, and poverty. We will not give up. According to Ali, in Israel, poverty rate for Jews is about 15%, while for Arab citizens is over 50%. Just like Canada's settler-native divide. Liberty and Justice for All says that's why they receive more financial aid than any place on planet Earth.
Yes, it is. Israel is still in a political deadlock, but this time there is a game changer in the way that the main competition will be between two right-wingers. And the only question is who of both of them, Benjamin Netanyahu or Gideon Saar, will be the next prime minister. Both are very tough nationalists and right-wingers, and it's not good news for Israel. But right now, they are the two only candidates with chances, obviously. Not a possible government. I mean, it was a big government with very little agreements, and above all, personal things were the main issue, mainly the charges against the prime minister. And you cannot run a country, especially not in times of corona, you cannot run a country with such a government. I mean, it was very clear that this government cannot function. Above all, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, he takes the responsibility. In the last years, it's not really government, because Netanyahu does whatever he wants. He really became a one-show man, for the good and for the bad, and all the responsibility is on his shoulder. For the good and for the bad, the good things that happen to Israel, the bad things that happen to Israel, they are right now all Netanyahu, because he doesn't let anyone else really to run any kind of independent policy.
One of the pivotal moments in Israel was the so-called deal of the century. Of course, it failed, but it had huge repercussions for the native Arab population of Israel. The so-called deal of the century will only impact the indigenous Arab population in Israel. The so-called deal would have made hundreds of thousands of them lose their citizenships and would change the status of their communities. It would make their neighborhoods a Palestinian enclave, cut up from the neighboring occupied West Bank by an Israeli barrier known as the Apartheid Wall. The so-called deal would put over 300,000 of them at risk of being transferred out of their ancestral home of pre-1948 occupied Palestine. So far, this won't happen, but it's not a new plot. Israel has been working on this since 1948.
The population has been vocal this year over that and Israel's discriminatory and apartheid tactics against them. They believe that Israel wants them out. At least according to the debt deal of the century, Israel wanted to isolate them, to make them apart from the occupied territories. The population represents over 20% of Israel, and Tel Aviv feels threatened by them.
It could be in a practice, yes, for our generation. It's another Nakba. It's a sort of Nakba for our community. First of all, we have extended the lands all over the country and not just in our residential areas. So as part of the Palestinian people, we have extended historical rights that we are demanding. Many of us here in the Triangle are uprooted Palestinians, which means that they are internally displaced citizens. Our original villages were destroyed back in 48 during the Nakba. We are still demanding, and we will continue to demand returning to our destroyed villages like Lajon and El Mizinat and El Kafrin. And this demand basically will be impossible if they implement this transfer. So maybe the idea is not to uproot us from our homes, but it's definitely to uproot us from our historical lands and to deny our right in these lands. So for us, this is an important issue. I believe that Netanyahu included this provision about the transfer of the Arab community of the Triangle in advance of the election as part of his campaign against Arab citizens and against the joint list, the political representative of Arab citizens in Israel. Netanyahu knows that we are influential and that our votes affect the national map in Israel and could affect who will be the prime minister in Israel. This is the reason why he is trying to weaken our struggle, to weaken our political maneuver and political activity. And part of that is basically to have less Arabs and basically to have less voters and less representatives in the Knesset. This is a clearly racist motivation. Netanyahu is very worried about our gradually influential role within Israeli politics.
A recent video on social media shows Israeli Arabs walking around in Tel Aviv pretending to be Emirates, while Israelis waited in line to be photographed with them. In fact, they were trying to show how welcoming Israelis were towards Emirates, while discriminating against the original people of the land. On social media, the conversation was tense. Abir says, it's almost like Israelis aren't racist against Arabs. Mujib says, this is the Palestinian town inside the Green Line, where the Israeli military massacred scores of defenseless Muslim civilians during the Suez War of 1956.
The deal of the century is there to serve Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. It is about the Jews, it's about the Israelis, it turns a blind eye to the Palestinians, to the plight, to their cause, and it is hardly a surprise that it didn't find many enthusiasts among the Palestinians. However, it was very useful in conveying the most important message to the Palestinians, that the Americans are not a negotiator, they are a side in this conflict.
No, it's dead together with Donald Trump, who is leaving the White House within 2 weeks. Nobody really took it seriously. There are those few agreements with four Arab states, which I don't want to underestimate. They have some value, but this is not the deal of the century, because the deal of the century was about to solve also the Palestinian issue, which is the main issue, and the Palestinian problem was not even touched. And therefore, we better forget about the deal of the century, and we will see what will the next administration offer, but I have no expectation.
Israel is in a political deadlock. However, politically and ideologically and unethically, they are more united than ever. What they really don't agree is to be ruled by Netanyahu, but in terms of their right-wing commitment, they are actually extremely united, and the left has evaporated into total nothingness. Israel failed to make changes because the Israeli political system in the last few years is not there to serve the Israelis, but one, to serve oligarchs around the world, two, to save Netanyahu from the legal complications inflicted on himself. Is doing the best he can to save himself, but he has found out that at least within the political system, he has a growing number of opponents. However, the Israeli public still support him and will support a government under his leadership. They like him.
According to the report by the Lated nonprofit, the portion of Israeli households living in poverty rose from 20.1% to 29.3% in 2020. This while the regime in Israel continues to ignore the issue, according to Israeli media. Israelis in general believe that Netanyahu is after saving himself from jail time, as he is accused of corruption and has a pending trial. Meanwhile, protests that have been taking place every week and sometimes every day for almost a year now are growing. Some believe that Israel is on the brink of an uprising that may reshape Israel forever. For now, 2020 is ending, but the crises faced by Israelis and Israel in general continue. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. A new survey conducted by the Abraham Initiatives has found that most Arab Israelis, 58%, would participate in the Israel protest movement against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if it highlighted ongoing issues facing the community, such as the economic situation and housing. Likewise, almost three-fourths, 73%, support the goals of the protest movement. I-24 News. UAE set to have suspended tourist visas for Israeli travelers. Several hundred Israeli passengers who landed in Dubai recently were denied entry into the United Arab Emirates, Israeli media report. According to the reports, the incident, which saw only Israelis holding other passports as well to enter, was caused by a change in the Emirati visa policy. Times of Israel. Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz warned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on that he would not be Prime Minister again if Israel goes to a fourth election in 2 years, and once again urged him to pass the 2020 budget. Ynet News. At least 25 people were arrested in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds as police clashed with thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews protesting the construction of a light railway line passing through their neighborhoods. A light railway line is set to go through the Bar Ilan area, with opponents saying it could disrupt the bus services and bring indecent behavior into the religious community.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
The three branches of government should work and cooperate together. In particular, the heads of the three branches. If such solidarity, unity, and cooperation are realized, national unity will certainly be strengthened on a daily basis. Well, one can negotiate. There are or might be certain differences. You should resolve them through negotiations. You speak about negotiating with the world. Very well. How is one able to negotiate with the world, but not able to negotiate with domestic forces? You should negotiate with one another and resolve the problems. Some of the comments that we hear these days are a source of sowing discord, not unity. The fourth and the last point, I have said this before as well, but I wish to repeat it again. Lifting the sanctions is in the hands of the enemy, but counteracting them is in our hands. Is this not the case? We cannot lift the sanctions on our own. It is the enemy who should do so. However, we ourselves are capable of counteracting the effects of his sanctions. Therefore, this takes priority and is the right course of action. We should follow the latter move.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sayyidul Aqwam.
course, I am not saying that we should not be after lifting the sanctions. If we are able to lift the sanctions, we should not delay it, even for an hour. Of course, there is a 4-year delay. Since year 1395 of the solar calendar, they have been intending to lift them all at once. But until today, not only have they not lifted, but they have also increased these sanctions. However, if we can lift them in a correct, reasonable, dignified, Islamic and Iranian way, we should do so. Nonetheless, you should not think too much about this. You should rather think about counteracting sanctions, which is an issue in your hands, as you are capable of doing it. And you should follow the matter and cooperate with one another in a diligent manner. This is my advice to you. I will support the officials of the country, but provided that they are committed to the nation's goals. I hope that Allah the Exalted will bestow on all the officials of the country the blessing to be able to accomplish great feats. God willing, greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients, charitable groups have warned. In a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
E quindi diventa sempre più difficile.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times.
Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
The situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally, because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kabella, London.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
Is very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, deputy head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Anjum Abdullahi, Kanu.
A ceremony attended by Syrians, Palestinians, Iranians, and Yemenis was held in Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria asserted that the resistance front will continue to fight back against any aggression, reiterating the assassination was a sign of the weakness of the United States.
By firing the missile on General Soleimani, the U.S. targeted the Iranian people, their power, and pride. The U.S. wanted to thwart the resistance front's plans, but they failed. They have no choice but to leave the region.
Delegates from Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party and Yemen also delivered words on General Soleimani and his achievements in leading resistance fighters against the Western plots in the region. Vice Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said General Soleimani told him the only path to liberate Palestine was armed struggle and national unity between Palestinians.
General Soleimani urged us to depend on ourselves instead of others. Thanks to his efforts and advices, today we make weapons and the Palestinian resistance is currently in constant development.
Photos of General Soleimani were also exhibited, showing moments of his missions across Syria and Iraq. For years, General Soleimani led Iranian military advisors in Syria at Syria's request and played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists as well as restoring security to hundreds of square kilometers across the Arab country. For over a week, Syrians, Iranians, and Palestinians have commemorated General Soleimani's martyrdom. And as observers say, contrary to the U.S. and its regional allies' will, General Soleimani's assassination has further strengthened unity among all members of the resistance front. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cédric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. 4 police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the 4 police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for their suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traoré is the sister of Adama Traoré, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traoré died exactly the same way as Cédric Chouviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cédric Chouviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law, that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in